I am CJ Wilson, and this is Josh Olswich, and we are the Bitcoin Bottom Line. We are going to be talking to you today about how to survive in choppy markets, right? We have a lot of volatility right now in the crypto space. Things are all over the place. The merge just happened a little bit ago, and so Bitcoin, Ethereum, all these other assets are kind of trading all over the place. Jerome Powell's hiking rates. We got all sorts of crazy stuff. It's ugly out there, Josh. What do we do?
It is ugly. Did you know that REM's Losing My Religion just hit 1 billion views on YouTube?
Wow. That's
And I bring this up because a lot of people will lose their faith in Bitcoin in times like this, you know?
That's true.
Especially the new coiners, well, they'll be focused on, you know, their all-time high in price, in portfolio value or whatever. And if you're here for the wrong reasons, you'll find out really quick. Right. And we can compare this to many, many other bear markets in Bitcoin. You know, we've only been around for 10 years, but we've had our fair share of 80% plus drawdowns, and we're on our way now. So for some of us, it's like, okay, we're at the previous all-time high. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you just got here, it's very much a big deal.
Yeah, if your first Bitcoin purchase was $45,000 or higher, and you're looking at an $18,000, $19,000 price, that is not happy in your portfolio. For those of us that maybe bought in the thousands, you know, $3,000, $5,000, $8,000, something like that, we're still kind of comfortable in the sense that, hey, we're above that. And we know that the volatility of Bitcoin on the downside is rewarded with all-time highs on the upside. But I think I was talking to somebody recently, and they said the hardest thing to do is to take profits. So I guess maybe we can start the conversation with that. When you see these huge whales in Bitcoin and this whale movement and stuff like that, that there are people that did dump the top at 60 plus, and then some of them bought back in thinking 30 was the bottom. And that was $10,000 ago, right? So how many people do you feel like are surviving as just traders versus people that are trading for some sort of, you know, in terms of the volume that's out there, in terms of like trading for like a pile of other people's money or like a hedge fund or something like that?
Yeah, volumes across the board are extremely down. They're down bad, CJ, including Bitcoin, including any exchange, including global numbers, like any way you want to measure it or look at it, even in DeFi, like all that volume is substantially lower than it was a few months ago. And the percentage of people who are just like Joe Public trading that is probably a just insignificant sliver of a volume, you know? So I think on balance, most people in the market now are not trading like they used to, for sure. Unless you have exposure to like short side of things or options or different ways that aren't just long only, because clearly that hasn't really worked out too well for you since November.
Yeah, long only works if you take profit and then buy back in at a lower price, right? But the problem is that in a market like this, you don't really know what the low is. And so you don't really know when you have a local high when to take profit off of the bottom. So I know for me personally, I have a couple different strategies. I have like a dollar cost average strategy where I buy a certain amount of Bitcoin every month and a certain amount of Bitcoin every week. Like two different things. Like, I have an automatic buy that hits when my paycheck hits, that goes and it just automatically clocks in, you know, some. And then I also buy dips. I try to do that. But the hardest thing for me is like today's price, you know, at time of recording is around 19 grand. So if it goes to 21 grand, it's like, okay, I could sell my $19,000 Bitcoin for 21,000 and take profit, so to speak. But then what do I do? How long do I wait to redeploy it? And I think that is such a mind trap. And we get into this conversation with Bitcoin maximalists all the time, which I would consider myself one. But then I also say, hey, like, there's a stock market out there, there's other things being traded. So I think the hard thing is when someone says you should be only Bitcoin and all of your money should be in Bitcoin, right now is maximum pain. That is like maximum pain scenario. Yeah. But if you have some Apple shares, or you have some sort of mutual funds or something like that. This is why I don't really understand all the time the people that are like, oh, you need to go all in on just really anything other than your marriage. Maybe you should go all in on that, because that's a really good investment if you make a good one, and a bad investment if you make a bad one. But it seems to me like trading is hard. Trading is very hard right now. But like, what as for you as someone that's been in the market for a while, like if you have money to deploy in a strategy, at what point do you start looking at different ratios of where your money is? And it could be anything, like where it's, you know, real estate investments, bonds, because we talked about that a little bit on the pre-show. You know, right now it seems like the winning strategy is not losing. Like that's like just don't lose your money, you know, and that's like the first goal, right?
Yeah, the people getting most of the money in the professional institutional level now were people that were literally just holding cash the entire time on the way down. Like I saw some stat that I'm gonna fail to remember, but these institutional allocators have never been allocated this much to cash on the way down this whole time. So yeah, you have to decide like what's your time horizon? Why are you here? What are your goals? You know, are your goals to like get out of the system? To do this peaceful protest and say, you know what, thanks, no thanks, to say Wall Street, no thanks, or whatever it is that your goal? Or is your goal just to make lunch money for tomorrow? Is it to make rent for this month? Is it to get Christmas gifts for your family? Like what, like people need to understand like why you're here, because if you're just trading, like day trading this stuff, you're gonna get just bulldozed.
Yeah,
This is
unless
not a
you.
tradable environment. It is extremely difficult.
Right. It's the only way it's tradable is if you have so much at stake, right? And you have all these safeties built in an amazing discipline, because you have to literally cycle out every little 5%, 3%, 2%, you know, dip and increase. As like otherwise you're not going to be growing your portfolio, right? So I think like people that are looking at this broadly, a lot of people say, oh, Bitcoin's down from its all-time high, you know, why would I want to buy it? It's like, well, that's the time to buy, right? It's not the time to sell. Recently, one of my friends from Clubhouse, Bitcoin Tina, he's been getting roasted on Twitter because he like has been, you know, shouting from the rooftops that like Bitcoin's going to go to whatever. He's been very price focused. He's also retired, and he's a trader, like it's what he used to do professionally or whatever. He used to work in the industry. So he recently admitted that he had to sell some of his Bitcoin, and people were like all over his case because he's like, well, I don't have income. Like I needed to pay bills. I had stuff I had to buy. I had food, like whatever. I had to sell some of my Bitcoin as a result of this. He's like, and it was painful because I didn't sell the top. I told myself I was going to sell the top, but I didn't. And I did a thing the other day where I was with all these wealth advisors and stuff like that, and I gave a speech that was like very inflammatory to the room, because it was about Bitcoin and about, like, you know, like you said, banks. No thanks. So I asked one of the guys that's been doing it way longer than me in terms of investing and stuff, and I said, what's harder, buying the right bottom or selling the right top? And he goes, selling the right top is the hardest thing to do. He's like, because you get emotionally attached, everybody's greedy. If it goes past, you know, you buy something for $20, it goes to $50, and you're thinking, oh, I'm 2.5x my money after taxes. I'm still way ahead. I should just sell. You know, he said, so what he said was, if you go in with a pile of money, you should have a full plan for how that money gets deployed in terms of where you're going to take profit on that, and then where you're going to like kind of reallocate that to the other buckets, like rebalance. So you have to constantly be rebalancing. And in this environment, I would say for the first time in however many years, bonds are actually making interest, right? And granted, the dollar sucks because CPI is 8% and everything like that, but you're positive 4% at least on the dollars in your bank account if you are holding bonds right now, because you can get a bond, a 2-year bond is like 4% or something. That's better than losing 20%, I guess, making the wrong moves, buying the wrong asset somewhere else.
Yeah, I guess the signals are so messy and muddy because we have inflation, we've got interest rates, and then you've got like DXY, which is global FX rates relative to the dollar, you know, in that bucket of DXY. So depending on where you are in the world, like it's who knows what you're doing, you know, because all this stuff is all over the place in regards to inflation and rates. But yeah, you 100% need you need a grand like summarized vision of what you're going to do with this money, where you're going to move it when we get to X level, like have a plan. Like if Bitcoin goes below 15, everybody needs to have a plan and say, okay, I'm either not going to sell anything. I'm going to sell something below 18, or I'm going to be a buyer below 15. Right. At every level, that's what you need, because I can tell you being here in 2015, when 2015 was, yeah, sub 200 prices, right? Like I was there on Coinbase, okay, and I was buying, because I thought, you know what? I'm already poor. What's the difference? Right?
I'm going to have fun staying poor.
If this thing goes to zero, like, and it's over, and it's actually over, because that was the second time we had broke 250 or whatever it was. I was like, you know what? If it's actually over, it's fine. But I think this is going to be a technology that's going to be around for a while. Mm-hmm. And that's why I stuck around. You really have to have that, like.
But 7 years later, right? That's what's, you've been doing this, you know, in that regard. Some of these people have only been in it 7 months, and it's been, you know, I would say poisonous, or whatever you want to call it. It's been a rough pill to swallow. But the way I look at it is, and this is from having experience in other markets, right? Equities, housing, and stuff like that. Because I bought a condo in Dallas in 06. Okay. So when the market dumped in 08, I don't know if the value of that condo has ever recovered. I mean, this has been 16 years, but I've had a renter in there at least, you know what I mean? So there's like mitigation strategies. And I guess then maybe that's the conversation to have, is what are your mitigation strategies if plan A doesn't go well? Like in racing, we would always say, oh, if you have a tire go down, you know, and you have to do an early tire change, well, then you need to change to a different fuel strategy. And so there's like a correlation to a new strategy means you have to go across the board a new strategy. So we didn't hit 100,000 for Bitcoin. It didn't go to 200,000 like Max Kaiser was telling everybody it was going to go to. But the adoption is still going up, right? There's still people using it. So at least we have NGU on the user side, or the wallet side, or whatever. There's more use cases. Lightning's getting stronger. So there's like still growth in the technology aspect of it. And so I think, and at the end of the day, that's what's going to catapult us to an next price leg. But right now, the mitigation strategy for me personally is definitely thinking about other assets that are hard to get, you know, whether that's land, whether that's like literally Rolexes, whether that's collector cars, whether that's just holding dollars, whether that's bonds. There are other mitigation strategies, but I just have to say, I have to go on record the saying, like, yeah, I do have Apple stock, right? And because it pays a dividend in Apple stock. And I believe in that company, even if, like, you know, people can call me whatever they want to call me, but that is a good company. Now, I don't hold Ethereum, right? And I have no interest in that because I think Bitcoin is better. So that's why I only have Bitcoin in that regard. But I think that you would be kind of like, it's hard to have a platform now where you have all these different assets you can trade, and whether that's through Robinhood or anything else, and not say, hey, like, maybe I should buy some of this stock for this company that seems to be profitable in many market conditions, you know, like holding Exxon stock or something like that. If they suddenly get into Bitcoin mining at a big scale, then yeah, that could be a massive play. And then suddenly that becomes the new Elon news or something, right? And I think that's where it's hard to have Bitcoin as, like, you know, a majority of your portfolio, a majority of your net worth. That's super volatile. But most people, it's not realistic, because new entrants, people that are just getting into this, they might have a car payment and a house and, you know, all these other things anyways. So I think this is where we get back into that asset allocation mix, which responsible people have always said, you know, risky assets should be either ultra long term or a small percentage of your portfolio. Because if you over allocate at the wrong time, you get wrecked. And that's what we're seeing right now. So I still don't think we're at capitulation, though. I don't think a lot of people have really sold, because I think that's where the volume is staying buoyed. It's like really just people buying little bits, like me, $20, $100, $300, whatever, here and there. Just like, oh, it's down to under 19 again. Okay, I'll buy $500 worth. And that seems to be like an okay strategy mentally for me, because that's like livable. But yeah, I like range trading when it goes from 18 to 20, 19 to 21, and trying to time that. That seems to be a lot more specific, but I still would rather be in an accumulation strategy for Bitcoin rather than having all of my Bitcoin on that deployment strategy with that. That's just, I don't know how I would sleep at night, you know?
Yeah, well, that's, you said it right there. That's what it's all about. Like, you don't want to be trading your lunch money or your rent, right? Like, the being able to sleep at night test is a signal that if you've got too much risk on, you're going to, you know, that's going to drive you nuts, because you should, that's your body, your mentality is literally telling you, I should not be doing this, but I'm doing it anyway, you know?
So do you think we're being manipulated right now by like the big forces? Or you think there's the evil bad guy behind the curtain, you know, Klaus Schwab and those people? Do you think they're actually trying to depress the price of Bitcoin right now because it's such a freedom technology that's against that? Is that like such a wild conspiratorial thing to say that the paper gold market's been manipulated for years, so maybe they're doing the same thing to Bitcoin?
I don't think it's wild to think about. I doubt that it's happening because we're still at 20K, you know, right? Like 20K since 2018, right? Like we're back at the previous all-time high. Like, what's the big deal? I don't know. Like, everyone's like, it's a bear market. It's a bear market. I'm like, guys, this is not a bear market yet.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we're down 50% plus from the highs. I get it. But to anybody who's been here for more than 3 years, 4 years, whatever, this is nothing. You know, social sentiment as a whole is still pretty high. So there's still plenty of hopium out there. There's still plenty of people saying like Bitcoin's going to be great. You know, it's when it flips, when everyone says Bitcoin's dead. We've already seen a few people drop the laser eyes. You know, when the HODL stuff quiets down even more and people are telling you, you know, you're an idiot, what are you doing? That's the social sentiment signal that I look for. Like, okay, we're getting closer now, right? Like,
where we get ostracized for being Bitcoiners again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
We need anger. We need fear. Like, we need all that stuff. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think we would get there sub 18, like if we were to drop new yearly lows. I don't want to go there, but.
Right. You know. So there's like the fear and greed index, but maybe there's something even more evolved from that, which is the sort of shit talking index, which is basically someone's making fun of you now for being a Bitcoiner. That's a different scale, right? So once you get like the closer someone is to you, right, you can have like random coworker or like dude at the restaurant, then you get in like taxi driver, then you get all the way to like spouse or like, you know, sibling or son, or once that person's making fun of you, that's like pegged on the fear thing. It's the same equivalent. So maybe we just need a new metric, which is sort of like the social vulnerability index or something like that of Bitcoiners, right? Because like when Bitcoin was 60 grand, I think everybody was going around like not staying humble like you're supposed to and just being like, we told you, we freaking told you, you know? And then, Bitcoin goes to like 30 and everyone turns around and be like, what were you telling me again? What was that? So I think it's like Bitcoiners are like vegans. Like, we can't shut up about what we are. It just is what it is.
Yeah. When you're at those highs in your portfolio or whatever your investment is, you definitely need to snapshot your sentiment and say, okay, like what was I thinking about at this time? Was I thinking about buying a house, buying a Tesla, like going on vacation? Like that's a signal that maybe you should, rebalance something. But right. Yeah, I have a friend who's an anesthesiologist, very smart guy, who just like, he's perfect at timing, like when to text me and tell me like, you're so stupid for like being involved in crypto, right? So like, that's a great signal for me to say, okay, like we're getting closer, you know?
Yeah.
Speaking of like social.
So that's good though. That's maybe that's something we could come up with. We come with the Valkyrie, social vulnerability score. And then you can say like, hey, what's the sentiment for like self-reporting? I'm getting this many people telling me I'm an idiot for buying Bitcoin. And then that's a signal that we're almost there.
Yeah. If you're like, if you're in crypto and your family is texting you, like, do you still have a job? Like that type of thing. Like that's usually a pretty good sign. Like, you know, like if you're here for the long term, then, that's probably a price low or getting there when it starts to bubble up into the mainstream press like that.
But like, okay. So in that sense, let's talk about like blue chip stocks on the stock market, right? Just as a broad thing. So you obviously have volatile stocks that people buy for $3 and they go up to $30 and there's a lot of alpha there. But there's a lot of core stocks and core allocations that people have. In the same sense, like I would say that the 60-40 portfolio that everyone's been getting pitched since they were like first had a job and, you know, got offered a 401k or something like that, of stocks, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or, you know, depending on what age you're at, you kind of change that mix around.
Yeah.
I think in that same sense, you know, a lot of people were talking about Bitcoin taking the place of bonds because they felt like because Bitcoin is a scarce asset, that it has a better place in a portfolio, like a huge like percentage of allocation, you know, being towards stocks or something like that, and having a small percentage towards Bitcoin made more sense than a 60-40, you know, stocks and bonds and no Bitcoin. But I think now it sort of seems like we're saying you need to do something to generate income. So if you don't have a job, like how are you generating income on your money? And the problem realistically, and this is a lot of people, I wouldn't say fell for it, but a lot of people kind of got sucked into the narrative on this with, putting money on BlockFi or Celsius or whatever, was, oh, and I can hold more Bitcoin than I would normally hold or allocate as a percentage because I'm getting a dividend on that. I'm getting more Bitcoin or Bitcoin yield or something. But I think that that mentality really is the most dangerous thing right now, is the sort of yield chasing in the crypto space. And I feel like the merge has sort of pulled a curtain back where people are like, wait a second, now there's people talking about they can't move their stuff right away. So that to me is kind of scary. But I think I still feel good about holding dividend paying stocks better than I would dividend paying crypto, if that makes sense, depending on where that is stored or whatever else. Because I think holding the underlying asset, meaning like holding Bitcoin as an underlying asset myself, self-custody, or through a trust or something like that, seems to be like a little bit better, you know, a little bit easier for me personally to sleep at night versus like, you know, having someone tell me it's going to generate, you know, 6% in Bitcoin terms or something crazy like that. That's to me, that's just wacky, because this environment, you can't generate that kind of yield, you know, I don't think.
Yeah. When you're lending assets, you have to realize like someone else is taking those assets and using them to get the payment for you, not, and mm-hmm. plus what they're getting. Right. So,
but a company like Apple, for instance, has profit, right? So, and you can, they're self-reporting that, you can see it, you know, there's a product there. So I still think that like blue chip stocks, this is what I'm trying to say, roundabout, blue chip stocks are okay to hold in your portfolio, in a broad portfolio of money that you have, retirement, whatever it is. And it's just sort of like, sometimes the unsexy investments are sort of the safer ones, and you need to have an unsexy plan, you know, as a mitigation strategy, not just like the kickback and like moon, you know, cause I don't think that's, you know, that's proving to be, like you said, long only is not a safe place to park your boat right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons I've always had a job, like that way I always have income to like pay bills, right. Cost of living. And I don't have to sell cold storage to function as a person, you know?
So core assets in your portfolio, right? Dividend stocks, blue chip stocks, bonds, you know, like how much as a trader, as an experienced analyst and stuff like that, how much would you see like plan A versus plan B, you know, swing, right? Because I mean, obviously like you want your winners to win. So when it's a bull market, you sort of like risk on, right? But now we're seeing risk off across the board, and risk off is basically fixed income is the that's the sexy thing during risk off, right?
Yeah, so higher rates mean that cost of capital goes up, opportunity cost goes up. Like you have to outperform the risk-free rate mm-hmm. to attract that capital. And if you're not, then they're going to sit in the risk-free rate. Why risk anything? Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm stumbling today. Why risk anything if you're getting 4% guaranteed, right? Zero risk. Right. So that pushes assets further down, because then no one's deploying anything if the risk-free rate is that high. Which is one of the reasons we've enjoyed the bull market for so long in TradFi. Rates have been so low mm-hmm. that the risk-free rate just wasn't there. So people had to find a place to put stuff, right?
Right.
So they put it into risk. They put it into art and all sorts of NFT stuff, right? I just saw, I think like the all-time high in like the baseball card scene for an auction was mm-hmm. like last month. Like, which is crazy to think, like everything else is like way down, mm-hmm. but collectibles are still seeing this crazy market, at least the high end collectibles.
So the high end collectibles is a really interesting study. Okay. Because when you have a physical thing, you can move it from place to place. Right. And you'd think that there's like this, let's say art collection or something like that, that becomes like an heirloom at some point. Right. And I think the thing is that when you look at like antique art or like Renaissance art or something like that, like a Da Vinci or, you know, something that's really like legitimately hundreds of years old, imagine like trying to give someone instructions, like writing a smart contract for the Mona Lisa, you know, like how would you even like how would you deploy like a custodial model for that so that your heirs don't screw it up? And that's such like a weird thing for me to think about, but I do think about that sometimes, because we do see master artworks that just continue to accelerate with no end in sight. There's no limit to how much someone's willing to pay for Starry Night, right? I mean, like at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. And when you have a singular thing, like a known masterwork from a Rembrandt or a Dali or a Van Gogh or something like that, like those could just keep going up forever, right? I mean, realistically, there's no cap on that. But when you see those products get financialized and it's like, oh, invest in collectible art, I'm like, dude, that's so weird to me. You know, it's still super weird. I don't understand how, if you don't have the $100 million to buy the painting, how do you think that you're going to benefit? You know, it just seems very strange.
Yeah, they've talked about like fractionalizing art and putting it on the blockchain in the for specifically like Mona Lisa type stuff. You know, but yeah, I don't know if that's ever going to work. Or Picasso, I think, was what they actually were talking about doing. But yeah, it's choppy out there. You got to know, like, are we trending? Are we ranging? Are we bullish? Are we bearish? Like, you have to be able to answer those basic questions at the bare minimum in order to like have any understanding of what's going on right now, right? You have to know what's driving this. If macro is driving this, if the Fed and inflation is driving everything, like, you may not like it, but you have to understand where those influences are coming from. You know, like, we like to think we're an inflation hedge, and maybe zoomed out long term we will be, but right now, from month to month, we certainly aren't, right?
Well, but this is okay. There's two different things here, right? There's being an inflation hedge from debasement of the currency, then there's being a macro hedge from macro environment inflation, right? And so macro environment inflation is different than fiscal inflation in the sense that there's like demand on one side and there's supply on the other side. So like money supply goes up, a lot of assets get inflated, right? And then like you said, maybe the cost of capital is so low that risk assets go up as a result of that. But like when supply chain things break down and people need money to survive, then they have to extract money out of other assets just to pay for their living. And that's like a different, so the macro inflation versus, you know, like money supply inflation, those are, to me, those are two different things. And I think it's very important that people understand that, because like, you know, Augusto Carstens or whatever the guy's name is, that looks like his buttons are always going to pop off and break the sound barrier.
Oh, yeah.
That dude is like, hey, we want to do CBDCs because we want to control people's spending. We want money to expire. I'm like, what is it? Is a banana now? Like, what's going on? That is a totally different scenario than like, hey, money is not worth anything, and the Turkish lira is dropping in price, and you need to put money somewhere else. And so you buy Bitcoin as a hedge against the Turkish lira imploding, right? So I think like what we're seeing right now is like the sine wave acceleration. Like things are changing. I know like some people talk about like fractals and all this other stuff, but basically the rate of change is unpredictable right now. Everything's volatile. And as the swings get more violent, you know what I mean? Like we don't really know where that turn is going to be, where it goes from a bottom back to like an increase in asset prices. And that could be stock market, that could be Bitcoin. And that's for me, what's like the hardest to navigate, is because you get emotional about fear, you get emotional about joy, and you think you're winning. And then like you get snipered from something you can't control. And it's really the most important thing, like you said, is understanding your total risk profile and why your thesis is that things are happening. But I think we're in for a pretty ugly period of time where the, you know, IMF and the Fed and all this stuff, they're going to have so much influence, you know, over everything that's happening, or they're going to be trying to just keep cranking dials to get things to stabilize. But all they're doing is basically extending the time period that the wobble is going to be on. And that's really what I worry about. I worry that if things just like smash into each other and eventually they hit a stop, and then we can kind of rebuild and then figure out what's reality. But right now we don't even know where the horizon is, because you have, you know, this country's printing money, this country's not printing money, this country's selling oil, this country's buying oil. Like there's all these macro factors that are stretching everything across. And the only thing that you can really tell, at least I can tell from just what I'm getting, is countries are trying to de-dollarize across the board. CBDCs are like increasingly coming.
They're ratcheting up. If you had asked me a couple of years ago if CBDCs were at the state they were, I would have said no way, right? Like it's happening quicker than I thought. We always think like government's super slow, but maybe not governments everywhere. We're seeing what we're seeing in China is definitely acceleration in the CBDC game. You know, ever since they banned Bitcoin miners, they have been all about CBDCs. Mm-hmm. They like waffled back and forth on Bitcoin as far as letting it exist or not, and then the miners existing or not. And then after that, it's just been full-blown CBDC pilots everywhere, provinces rolling it out, using it to encourage people to like buy into it, right? And like you said, mm-hmm. having this expiration on when you can use it, telling you can only use it for certain things, connecting it to social credit score. These are all things like I think as Americans, we like think, oh, that's not going to happen here, right?
But we're only one country in the world, and we have less than, you know, like 5% of the global population lives in America, right? So we don't have that much influence over anything other than Marvel movies and, you know, like, I guess Hollywood, that's in the Kardashians. That's like really like pop culture is where America has the most outsized influence. But from a financial standpoint, the totalitarian countries or the just this mega population countries like India, they're gonna have more influence over their people. But what's I've been reading recently that India's adoption of Bitcoin, or at least usage of Bitcoin, has been going up. So that's bullish, I think, in a long-term sense. But like that country has been such a gold country and such a economic, like, when are they going to take off? But they keep kind of trapping themselves in this mentality of either class warfare or whatever. If India becomes a really productive economy and they start supplying, you know, other countries with food and this supplying other, if they pick up basically, you know, and start as a supplier economy, then India could be a huge winner, you know, from this global destabilization that we're seeing right now. As Iran comes out and says that they want to do their own digital currency, China has a digital currency, obviously Venezuela tried it. You know, you kind of wonder who's actually working on these projects from like a developer coding standpoint. How are they going to roll it out? And the most hilarious thing would be if a CBDC comes in and the American government, for some reason, and we can't vote them out before they do it, they try to push this on us and it fails. It's going to be like catastrophic to a lot of programs. It's going to be catastrophic to a lot of careers. But there's probably some people that have really been very good. Let's say, Red Hat hackers or whatever over the years that are kind of thinking, hey, like whatever you guys try to come out with, we're going to come out with a workaround, or we're just going to take it down the same way that you see, you know, these kind of state sponsored hackers take down, you know, DeFi exchanges and stuff like that. I just think that a CBDC is such a terrible play, you know, in the strategy of government, that it just opens up this huge vulnerability. Because you have all these people that are not technical trying to then regulate a technical thing like a digital currency. They don't know what they're doing, right? And Bitcoin's already been around for 13 years. They still can't figure that out for the most part. And like, let alone a native technology that's, or a native currency that's new. It's just, to me, it's going to be bonkers. They're going to blow it. And it's going to create even more Panic at the Disco in that regard.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if China is undergoing any issues in like the cybersecurity side of things in regards to the CBDC. I don't think they would tell us that they were if they had
any issues. We would never know. So these stupid American like congressmen and stuff like that, they're like, oh, look, China did it. We should just do what they did. It's like, oh, yeah, China also has a zero COVID policy. How'd that work? You know what I mean? Like, obviously, we can't necessarily trust their data. Okay. Like, right, it's not necessarily the most reliable source. They're not open source. It's not, China doesn't have a GitHub for their CBDC, right?
No. So, yeah, I think it'll start at like the public assistance level, food stamps, social security, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. If it even like rolls out quickly, which I think it sounds like there's enough like political will to get it done. Whether or not they can actually execute, like you're saying, on a technical level, we'll see. But I could see it within the next 5 years in the United States, some form of it.
You know? If you are listening to this and you're a developer and you get hired by the government to develop a CBDC, you're for sure going to go to hell. I'm just throwing that out there. I'm willing to throw that one. Like, man. No, it's such a bummer, right, to see some of this stuff. And I hate to say it, but... you know, there's just certain people that if they stump for this too hard, it could be political suicide for them as well. I think it should be, or it could be. So I think the checklist for surviving the CBDC is have Bitcoin, know how to access cash, have income that you have, don't depend on government income, because if they brick the technology, or they brick the wallet somehow on accident, or they hard fork it and you don't upgrade in time because you're on vacation, you're gonna get nuked. Yeah, exactly. If you're receiving government assistance and you're on vacation, like, we need to have a conversation. Yeah. You're just, like, not doing this. Like, I'd like to know how you manage that. I think that the digital currency landscape is, I think it's alive and well in a lot of cases. I worry a little bit that the government is seeing the opportunity as a power grab to do it, and they're gonna try to do it themselves instead of staying out of it and just letting the free market decide what currencies are good. I think the dollar still is the best currency in the world. We've seen the euro crash, the pound crash recently. So I'm going on vacation at some point to Europe. I'm very happy to go buy some stuff in Europe at a depressed rate. But that's the sort of the macro tourist angle that we get to deploy those dollars. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think that if anybody's counting on the CBDC for making their life better, I think they're mistaken, I guess, is my big finish.
Yeah, that's fair. I think there's some good that could come of it, but again, it's got to stay towards people who are already receiving public assistance, who already see restrictions on what they're able to do with that money. You know, you can't go somewhere like a liquor store and buy something with food stamps, right? So like, that's not out of the question in my mind as far as what's viable. It's just if it goes beyond that, right? Like if Walmart starts paying their employees in CBDCs because they get some benefit, you know, then it's a slippery slope, right? As far as how that gets rolled out.
Yeah, because then all of a sudden you have good money versus bad money, and, you know, good currency versus bad currency. And listen, that's a, like, good and bad is a very, like, wide ranging, you know, they're very wide buckets, you know. But specifically, I just feel deep down in the bottom of my heart and my wallet, like, I want more privacy, not less privacy. I want less intervention, you know, and those two things, the more privacy and less intervention, I don't see that in anything other than a cash or a Bitcoin being positive for me personally. And so I'd rather take, at that point, you know, all my salary in Bitcoin versus any percentage of it in CBDCs. Just and this just because, from a principal standpoint, you know, this has nothing to do with, like, what I like, how I spend my money or anything weird. I mean, I'm like a car dealer, you know, with like a Googleable net worth, I guess. But I just don't want to encourage that. You know, I think that takes us, you look at where that could take us 20 years from now, and I just see dystopian effects of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, just to wrap it up, we wide ranging today, from trading to CBDCs.
Yeah.
I think that on the political spectrum, though, a lot of people are getting more and more informed about crypto. They know more and more and more. We're seeing more and more regulation, good or bad, coming down the pipe, especially relative to stablecoins. I think stablecoins are probably the easiest thing to understand. So that's why we're seeing this ramping of legislation. Mm-hmm. And stablecoins blew up in a big way, obviously, over the past few months. But that will lead to the CBDC stuff, because it's analogous to stablecoins in a lot of ways. And, you know, you just have to decide your time horizons, why you're here, what you're here for, what are your goals, and if you can sleep at night. That's really all it comes down to. As somebody who's slept through several bear markets and continues to sleep rather well, I can tell you that if you're on this multi-year, multi-decade time horizon, you know, what is there to worry about, CJ?
Multi-decade time horizon skill sets, that's maybe the next episode that we need to do, because so many people are focused, you know, and fearful of next week, that they don't make the right plans for the next decade, and they make mistakes because they're not looking far enough ahead. So I think that's a great idea from you, and a great sentiment to say that regardless of the bear market that we might be in right now, if we think where we've come from, right, take a step back, hey, where have we come from? How do we get here? And as a result of that trajectory, right, where can it get to in the next 5 to 10 years? I'm still very positive in that regard. I just think that, yeah, like with everything else, there's these time periods, 2 months, 8 months, 28 months, whatever, where we're gonna have a lot of shaking and, gravitational challenges that we're gonna have to deal with. We can get through all that. We're people, we're adaptable. We can change our spending habits, our living habits, our eating habits, our fitness habits. We can become better and stronger, develop better networks, and emerge evolved from the bear market.
That's
That's
right.
my goal.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'll leave it there.
All right. And that's not necessarily financial advice, but
Definitely none of this, by the way. It may have sounded a lot like financial advice, but
it's
I can
financial
assure you,
commentary. Financial commentary.
no NFA, no financial advice.
Cool. Josh, thanks for joining me. I wish you luck and happy sleeps out there, and I will talk to you soon.